listening to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast with your host, Jessica Strang, and your co-host, Jennifer Trevelli. If you've ever wanted to start therapy but didn't know where to begin, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, we will offer, what you call Therapy 101 by interviewing experts in the field and asking them anything and everything you want to know about therapy before you make that first appointment. Autumn Starks is a licensed clinical social worker, and she leads Starks Therapy Group in Oak Park, Illinois. Autumn has been practicing psychotherapy for 15 years, and she focuses on treating individuals with trauma and mood disorders, as well as the treatment of other therapists using internal family systems therapy. She also specializes in working with people healing from religious trauma. Autumn has also been certified as a psychedelic-assisted therapist through the Integrative Psychiatry Institute. And she works extensively with ketamine-assisted therapy, both personally and in her practice with clients. We are so excited to discuss everything you want to know about depression and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy with our guest expert, Autumn Starks. Autumn Starks, welcome to our show tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, y'all.
Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, we're excited to talk with you and learn more about what you have to share with us today.
Sounds good.
Yes, we are very, very excited. Autumn and I, and Jen, you're on this too, right? Like this little Chicagoland therapy listserv, and she had posted something very interesting. That's why it compelled me to contact her to talk a little bit about something interesting that she works on in therapy, which we'll get to. But before mm-hmm. we do that, we'll ask some questions that we typically ask all our guests. I almost said clients because I was thinking about my own. But what we ask our guests is we really like to know kind of like the behind the scenes of therapists. It's kind of the questions that most of our therapy clients don't ask, because we're there to service them and fill their needs. But we like to know a little bit more about the guests that we have on. So if you don't mind telling us, when did you start studying psychology? Whenever that was, those early experiences that kind of drew you to the field?
Well, I'll start just like a client. It all started when I was 5 years old.
Exactly.
I joke about that, but I feel like relationships and finding belonging in them has been my life's work from the time I was young. So I always joke that I've been a therapist since I was young, helping my classmates like not fight over the blue crayon, helping my 13-year-old peers with their really dumb parents, right? You know? But my formal education in psychology began when I was in undergrad. I was a psych major. I also studied religion at the time. And then I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So I have my master's degree in social work, which is a sort of therapy, one of the therapy trainings you can go through. And so that's how I got my start. But you all know the real story now.
Yeah.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit kind of about what your current work and your current position is?
Sure thing. So I lead Starks Therapy Group. We're a small private practice here in Oak Park. We see adults, teens, kids for therapy. We run a couple of groups and we run actually a pretty eclectic staff that does quite a few different types of therapy. So not everybody on the team specializes in what I'm going to talk with you all about tonight. I come from an internal family systems lens, which is another conversation for a different podcast, but it's a very experiential form of therapy, going inside, attending to the different parts of us that come up. If you've ever gone through a breakup and you're like, part of me just wants her to call me back and the other part of me wants to key her car, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say it's parts work therapy. And so from that place, I became interested in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and psychedelic therapy. So not to spoil the end, but we'll end up there eventually.
Yes, absolutely. And, mm-hmm. One of the reasons why we started to want to talk to you was because of that work. But let's start off with the big piece of the work that you do, and that is working with depression and clients with depression. It's something that a lot of us clinicians it's kind of our bread and butter. Most people are coming in with this particular diagnostic, diagnosis, I mean. And so when did you become interested in working specifically with depression, or your thoughts on working with clients with depression?
Yeah, such a good question. So depression, including seasonal depression, really runs in my family. I struggled a lot in college and then had postpartum depression pretty seriously with my oldest daughter when she was born. And, you know, maybe your listeners know this, but so many therapists end up drawn to the areas where they have curiosity. And sometimes that curiosity is because of their own experiences and struggles. I became really, I think, especially with seasonal affective disorder, seasonal depression, just became so fascinated by the mind-body connection, how our mood impacts our actions and vice versa. And then in graduate school, one of my internships was at the Boston Center for Refugee Health and Human Rights. It's a big name. Basically, I was a 22-year-old baby therapist working with survivors of torture, actually.
Wow.
It was very intense. I probably honestly had no business doing that. And I learned a lot. And something that really surprised me in that work was learning that folks with serious trauma, not that we do a lot of trauma comparison here, but profound trauma were twice as likely to develop major depressive disorder than PTSD. And that blew my little grad school brain, right? Like that this person is coming to me with depression symptoms and not like the classical PTSD symptoms. And honestly, many people surviving trauma go on to develop both. And that just changed. It like radically changed my perception of depression, other mental health diagnoses, how they connect to each other, how they inform one another. And so I think most therapists end up really learning quite a lot about depression, no matter their specialization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so depression, I think, is something that most people have a general understanding of what it is, but we like to, on our podcast, kind of take it back to like very basics. So can you talk to us about what is depression?
Yeah, let's do it. So clinicians, when we talk about depression, we're typically referring to something that is more broadly or more specifically rather called major depressive disorder. It's a diagnosis that can get given to folks who meet certain criteria. So those criteria, I'm going to nerd out on the list here just so people are well informed.
Good. We need to know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, please,
right?
Nerd out, nerd away.
Okay. Well, you're going to just get a whole lot of that from me. So it can include things like feeling down or sad for more than 2 weeks, losing interest in finding things that used to be engaging for you, foggy thinking, big changes to your food intake, to your sleeping, that can be a lot more or a lot less than normal. It can also include things like being agitated, your movements really slowing down, fatigue, feelings of worthlessness, and also guilt that doesn't track given the situation, like a guilty negative lens. For some with major depressive disorder and other mood disorders, it can also be accompanied by thoughts of death, thoughts of suicide, which I think is just so important to talk about. Depression. So if we're going to focus in on major depressive disorder, again, I already gave that caveat that a lot of this stuff is interconnected and the nuance between labels can be something that we're all spending a lifetime learning to suss out better, I think.
Right.
But it can be caused by in order to meet the criteria for major depressive disorder, it has to not be caused by a physiological concern, like an injury or a substance that could be resolved and then the depression would resolve, right? And it must impact your functioning day to day and not be better explained by another mental health label. We call that differential diagnosis. That's the fancy word for you all to learn.
I think that's great to differentiate that because I think what gets tossed around, I think a lot of times in like for non-psychologists or non people that are not in the field is words like I'm so sad, I'm depressed. And it kind of, makes you think, well, are you, what does that look like? But I think you outlined a great criteria that, the DSM criteria of what it looks like. And that the important part that I think, just to focus on too, is the piece about, you know, it is impacting your day to day. So it's not just like I'm sad today and then tomorrow it was like, you know, sunny and everything was great. It's almost like a cloud, like a Charlie Brown cloud hanging over your head is what I think about it a lot. How would you differentiate then being, you know, like I said, just being sad versus grief and depression? Mm-hmm. Because I think that's also one of those things that happens is, you know, if somebody passed away or we have a sudden loss, that could trigger those feelings of sadness, and they may last for more than a few weeks. Mm-hmm. How would you differentiate that, or how should we, you know, the general public look at that?
Sure. So obviously everybody experiences sadness sometimes, and it's especially true after a big change or loss, which is, you know, what you're referring to as grief. Those grieving a specific loss, they can also meet the criteria for depression and receive treatment, or they can meet the criteria for something like an adjustment disorder, which is that somebody's had a major life change that they're not, that's really deeply impacting their mood, their functioning, maybe some anxiety. I would say that in general, folks don't come into treatment being like, I'm sad. And after a conversation, I'm like, you know what? It seems like you're just sad. I think you're going to be okay. it's much more, and maybe some would say that, you know, therapists are a hammer, so all we see is nails. But I would say that, right?
That's true.
And I want to be cognizant of that. I want to try to be open-minded with my clients and take them from at face value, beginner's mind, a fresh start. And I think what we see much more often is that it takes folks years to decide that their depression is finally, quote, bad enough to come and get some support. Mm-hmm. We know that though we said it has to last for longer than 2 weeks, I find that number, although maybe logistically helpful, pretty impractical. Nobody is on day 10 of feeling sad and in a therapist office. It takes time to make those decisions, to get up the courage, to figure out how your insurance works. And so though that's like a logistic number that we're using, it's, I think if you're asking that question, it's important to be asking it with a therapist who's going to help you to maybe see the ways that you could be minimizing symptoms. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of times, you know, we see people who feel really guilty because their depression wasn't like, quote, caused by something. Mm-hmm. They want an explanation for it. And they tend to feel like, especially, I mean, given like the world circumstances that we're all witnessing, we can compare our suffering and say, well, I don't really have a reason to be sad. Depression is more complicated than that. All mood disorders are. But I think it's important that we make room to step out of that comparison and think about what is our day-to-day life like? What is our thought life like? We can become such an echo chamber that until we take the step to let somebody in, we can't always see how bad it's gotten. Depression is, it's so common for people to have a really negative lens, and that includes their lens about whether or not they deserve help, about whether or not their problems are real. When I think about grief and depression, the other thing I think about is it's common to say, like, if somebody's had a loss, a death in the family, that they can sit with that grief for some time and it can turn into depression. The grief that I see even more than that is the grief caused by having years of untreated depression, that lost time, that loss of relationship, the isolation, the profound suffering. As people get better, they often also need to grieve what their depression took from them. And so I think people are nervous. They don't want to be seen as asking for more help than they deserve. And I don't know what you all would say about that, but that's just not something that we feel worried about as therapists, right?
Agreed. I think that there's no comparison between one person's grief and the other person's grief. And I think that, but it's also very symptomatic, you know, of people with depression, of that guilt of like, I'm taking your spot here as a client. Whereas somebody else with a worse trauma or episode of depression could be here. And I hear that quite often. So hand in hand with depression.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I just want to say to the client who's listening to this, but like, we have time and space for you. We've set up our lives to set up time and space for you. Not every therapist does. And it's important to talk with people until you find the person that not only demonstrates that they have that time and space for you to be honest about whatever you're experiencing, and that you can feel it mm-hmm. from them, that you know that they are hearing you and present with you, and that you matter to them. That, I mean, that should be the bare minimum, right?
you think, but we also had an episode maybe like 2 years ago about like what are bad therapists, and there was a lot of comments that were given to us, you know, like what people's experiences are. So it's not always, you know, it's just like a bad hairdresser, a bad mechanic. Unfortunately, there are some mm-hmm. therapists that are not giving that bare minimum that you're talking about.
Yeah. And so if that's your therapist, bring it up to them. And if they can't track in that conversation, it's okay to go elsewhere.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. Autumn, you touched a little bit on like major depressive disorder. Can you discuss with us some different types of depression and what might be some causes or treatment that is typically common with the different types of depression?
Sure. So major depressive disorder, it falls under this umbrella of mood disorders. So other terms like bipolar disorder, seasonal affective disorder, which is seasonal depression. I was talking about that earlier. PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Those all fall under this umbrella of mood disorders alongside things like depression. And many of those have their own causes and treatments, right? So seasonal affective disorder is often well treated by supplementing vitamin D, though not always. Mm-hmm. PMDD has to do with the menstrual cycle. Bipolar disorders have a very complicated other sort of neurological piece that is, yeah, very complicated and its own whole conversation, right? But in general, depression and some of these other depressive disorders are caused by genetics, environmental and biological factors, and they're also contributed to by psychosocial factors. So what I mean by this is that our bodies and our living situations and our stressors and our family histories, they all contribute and play a role in what shows up as a mood disorder or as depression. So very rarely is it like this one vitamin deficiency, right? Mm-hmm. Although that can be the case for certain things, and we want to rule those out as therapists. That's why you got to go and talk to a therapist about this. It's too complicated. We've made it our life's work to understand this. Let us help you with this conversation. Mm-hmm. I also think it's important to mention that it used to be believed that with depression specifically, it was related to easy to understand brain chemistry. And that if we just tweak mm-hmm. somebody's serotonin, their norepinephrine, their dopamine in the right way, that we could easily reduce depression symptoms for most people. To be clear, those medications that do that are life-saving. They're important. We need to make them available to people. And we've learned that depression symptoms are more closely related to very complex neural systems in the brain whose secondary effects are those neurotransmitters like serotonin. So just to give you a metaphor, we've been messing around downstream with serotonin, and what we're learning is that we, for some folks, that's not enough. We need to go back upstream to the mm-hmm. more complicated, harder to understand brain processes, and we can make some tweaks there, and there's some different treatments that target that can cause the downstream effect of the system itself better regulating some of those neurotransmitters. And so that's kind of another geek out moment about it, but it's been a huge breakthrough to see that, because not everybody has been helped by antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And mm-hmm. that's really can be like scary. If somebody's gotten their hope up for that and they don't work, they can make people at more risk for their safety. So yeah, I think it's good to say we know more. We know more this year than we knew last year, which is cool.
It is extremely cool. I mean, I think you know, what you're saying is that basically, like, we've kind of been throwing, like, it's like pasta at the wall for a while. You know, yeah. What is sticking, you know, and it's like, it turns out, no, there's nothing wrong with you because Lexapro doesn't work for you or whatnot. Yeah, and it's,
that's right.
It is a conversation, I think, that as a provider I have with my clients when they're seeking out, you know, psychiatric help in addition to, you know, the therapy that I provide, because it's not a one size fits all medication.
No.
So it's already hard to find the psychiatrist that actually will talk to you, which is a different story for a different day. And then one that will talk to the therapist, you know what I mean? That's another story. Then on top of that, going through a whole regimen of medications that you don't know which one's going to fit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that you had brought up a few minutes ago was talking about the timeline, you know, the DSM, and I keep saying DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that has all the diagnoses that we're talking about, including depression. For those who don't know what that is, but it's kind of like our blueprint for, you know, therapy and psychological disorders. And so in the DSM, it will say something like, you know, for at least X amount of time, 2 weeks, you know, or more, you've been having these feelings. Now, so chances are that, you know, like you said, our clients are not having those feelings. Most of the people are having it more than, you know, 12 days or 14 days or something like that, you know. So when you think about that, untreated, how, you know, how long will an actual episode last? If that client's coming in to see you, and maybe this isn't their first go at this rodeo, you know, how long will an actual episode last for depression if you don't treat it?
Sure. It varies wildly. I would say that in even that label of major depressive disorder, we have things like episodic versus more, I'm losing the word right now, but more consistent symptoms, things where people are feeling depressed for years at a time before they have a lift from their depressive episode. And there are some folks who are just going to be more episodic in nature. There may be a seasonal component. It may be a few weeks and they get to kind of know their rhythm and say, I feel myself dipping down. If I can make a medication adjustment, get back into therapy, move my body 3 times a week, I'm going to maybe be down here for 4 weeks and let's see if we can get a boost. And that's, I think, part of what's so hard about depression is we can't always predict the course of the condition. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in the midst of it, it feels like it won't stop, which is what leads to higher risk of things like suicide. There might be some statistics out there that were more articulate than I just was, but I like to kind of just name that we don't know. But it can be very long and it can be short. It's not, you know, a depression. If you're being diagnosed with depression for the first time and your symptoms have been around for 3 months, I'm also not sitting over here giving you a life sentence of a mood disorder. Mm-hmm. The earlier you can get some support around that, I think the greater odds people have of having it be more episodic versus a long-term chronic condition.
Absolutely. And I think it's helpful that you kind of shared that there's like, you know, sometimes there's not an answer to how long, because I think sometimes people come in looking for treatment and when they don't see a change right away, or they're not feeling better right away, or they have to try multiple different medications or multiple different options, then they start to feel like there's something wrong, even more so wrong with them, and feel like a failure, and it just kind of adds to that. So I think it's helpful for people to hear that. What are some of the treatments for depression? Like, what are you talked a little bit about medication, different medication options. What are some of kind of the typical treatments that people would use depending on severity of their depression?
Yeah, so there are many different types of treatments out there. And some of them have more of an evidence base than others. So I think that's important for people to know going and looking for treatment. It can be really hard to know what might work for you. You were just saying switching from medication. I think a good place to start is with therapy, with somebody who knows that their model that they're using, even if they're not, you know, scripting every session, but their framework is evidence-based for depression. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, narrative models of therapy. I mean, I could just sit here for another 20 minutes and I think it's important.
Name them all.
Yeah, name them all. Good luck. I think that it's important to, you can actually like go on YouTube and watch people's therapy sessions. So if you're curious about something we're saying, not real sessions, but like if they're training programs, like,
sure,
right? If you Google, so I'm an IFS therapist. If you go onto YouTube and you're like, let me see an IFS session, you're going to find like demo sessions and things like that. I think it's a good place to start to say, like, does this seem weird to me? Does this seem like a good fit for me? Let me listen to some podcasts. If you're listening to this, you're clearly a podcast listener. So to get a feel for if the model would be a good fit for you, medication like SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs, other atypical antidepressants, mood stabilizers can help. Typically, therapy and medication together has been considered like the gold standard for depression treatment. There are also all sorts of sort of alternative treatments, things like TMS. I can't think of what that stands for right now, but there's like sort of some brain oriented things. I'm going to say a scary thing, electroconvulsive therapy, ECT.
Not scary.
It sounds so scary. It's very different than what we saw in the movies. It's done very differently. And the I don't know enough about it really to speak about the evidence base. But because, like you said, we've been throwing spaghetti against the wall for 3 decades trying to see what we could help, how we could help people, there's lots and lots of options. We also know that movement, bringing gentle, self-sustaining movement into your life can be as effective for some people as things like SSRIs. And so many folks would benefit from the two together also. So the field I specialized in this sort of alternative treatment to SSRIs, or adjacent treatment, actually, it doesn't, one doesn't rule out the other, is ketamine-assisted psychotherapy for treatment-resistant depression. And I'm sure we'll get into that here, but it's got a strong evidence base. It makes a meaningful impact for about 90% of people. Again, not curing their depression, but relieving symptoms. And it's not a cure-all. It takes work, but it's one of the ones that, it's not really very new. It's been being used in this way since the 90s, but it's suddenly sort of coming into the spotlight here as people get really curious about psychedelic medicine and things like that.
And so before we get into that, I have a few more questions about the depression. Some of the things that, you know, sometimes there's listener questions, people that might, you know, write something in, and sometimes we also pull some of our good friends that just want to know more things. And so one of the questions is that if I already have had depression once, so I've had an episode at one point in my life, and it's already been treated, what is the possibility I'll have it again? Like, you know, what will I have it again? I guess is a question that one of our friends had wanted us to pose to you.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. The really unsatisfying answer is maybe.
Yeah.
It's likely that it could happen again. It's more likely to happen around major life stressors, any sort of physical concern, major life transition or changes. Of grief or loss could trigger something like that. And if you've already had depression and you've come out of it through like self-help, therapy, medication, whatever means, it's really good to write down, if you're well now and you're worried you're going to get depression later, I want you to make a note on your phone that says, in case I get depression later, these are the 10 things that I know supported my recovery. Because when you're in the middle of a depressive episode, it's really hard to think of those things.
So write that note
and text it to your friend, text it to somebody who will have the courage to send you that screenshot back and say, I'm feeling worried about you. What can I help you do from this list? Because you will know yourself better than your brand new therapist that you just met 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great little tip and like tidbit for our listeners. Cause it is something that when we kind of start to slip down into into more of that depressive episode, it is hard to sometimes think about, okay, what worked for me last time? What helped me get through this? And we kind of slip back into sometimes unhealthy patterns and unhealthy behaviors to try to alleviate how we're feeling.
Yeah. And it's so scary to feel it coming. That feeling of dread, like, oh no, I can feel the darkness. I can feel the cloud forming. I don't totally know why, or I can't control why. And it's, I think for some folks, depression becomes even less about the in the moment suffering, but the constant feeling of dread.
So. Absolutely. What are some things that people should expect and then or not expect when they're in therapy for depression?
Yeah, so people should expect to be believed of their experience of depression, and should expect for somebody who can take a step back and consider their both their biological, genetic, and the social and the neurological factors of depression. Not that your therapist has to be an expert on all of those, but you should expect for somebody to be asking you questions about those. I think any new therapy appointment, you should expect the person to be clear about boundaries, to be clear about asking you about your history slowly in a way that feel safe for you, given especially if you're somebody who's experienced trauma. Like I was saying, if you've had trauma, you're more likely to develop depression. So somebody who's willing to engage in that piece of it for you if it's relevant. And I think maybe this is going to be like a total bummer, not expecting to feel immediately better. And that doesn't mean that the treatment isn't working or that it isn't going to work. I know sticking with treatment when you're depressed is one of the last things you want to do, but just letting somebody be with you to bear witness to what you're going through. I know in this moment, if you're hearing this and you're depressed, you're like, that is not enough. I know, but let us do that for you because of the isolation. And honestly, because of the risk of suicide, it's important to us that we can bear witness to your pain and help you hold it so that you have more options available to you moving forward. Oof, that was dark. Sorry, y'all.
No. But it's true though. And I think that that other piece to it is that not all, and I'm just speaking from, again, from my client population, I've seen that all my clients that are depressed necessarily do turn to suicide, but that always is in the back of your head, depending on, previous attempt, if there's any, family history isn't big, one, two, right. It is something to think about. And I think that the other piece, like you said, was, when we talk a little bit about therapy in general with anybody, so more so with my depressed clients, but with any of my clients coming in, I always think of it as like we're climbing Mount Everest and I am like a Sherpa guide and we're going down this path, and we're going slowly and sometimes we go fast and sometimes we stumble, sometimes we plateau. Sometimes it doesn't feel good, but at some point we reach that apex, right? And then we can look down and see all the things that we've done in the past and we can look forward. But that takes a long time sometimes and it doesn't feel great every time. And that's hard. A hard truth to swallow for therapy. Oh,
yes. But what you really don't want is a therapist who's trying to cheer you up every session, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't feel good at all. I think maybe in this moment, it's a good time to mention, for a time was a community mental health trainer training lay people on how to respond to mental health crises. And we do a lot of training around suicidality specifically. And I just want every listener to hear that if you are worried about somebody around you, that they're depressed, if you have any sense that they might be having thoughts of suicide, it is okay to directly ask the people around you and to be honest yourself if you are having thoughts of suicide. It won't make your depression or their depression worse. It won't make people more suicidal. It won't put new ideas in people's head, including children, including teens. Mm-hmm. And it's so important to ask directly, to say, are you thinking about death? And it's so important to take it one step further and ask, depending on the emotional maturity, age, and understanding of this question, right? Are you thinking about killing yourself? We would have our trainees practice asking each other that question out loud. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Because it's a scary question to ask. And people are like, well, what if they say yes? If they say yes, or you're not sure, reach out to the suicide prevention lifelines that are available. You can usually call 988 on your phone. It rings to the area code that you're a part of. So for me, my area code isn't where I live anymore. But with this day of technology, a quick Google search is going to get you a suicide prevention lifeline. You can call those on other people's behalf and they can guide you. So you don't have to have all the answers, but you are the person there who can ask the question. Of course, that's not to guilt or shame anyone who has lost anyone by suicide. But I think it's just so important that everyone is given those instructions. It's okay mm-hmm. to ask directly. Please ask directly. You can't know what's going on in someone's head, but you can ask.
Absolutely. Right. I think like that you... Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, I like that you bring that up because I think there is such this misconception of if they're not thinking about it and I ask them, I'm going to be planting it into their head or I'm going to be making them feel this way. And it's such the opposite that once you kind of open that door, you've just let that person know that it is okay to talk about how you're feeling. It's okay to bring up and it's okay to have those thoughts. Like there are lots of times that people have those thoughts and they don't move beyond that thought. But if you're hesitant to talk about that with them and they're hesitant to talk about that with you, it closes that door where they could be getting the help.
Totally. And like, listen, I'm a therapist who treats people with depression and I sometimes need to take a long, slow breath before I ask that question. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be hesitant, to be scared you're going to get it wrong, and it's okay to ask anyway.
I really love it. And I think, John, you said it so best. It's the exact same sentiment I was having is that there is that fear, like I'm going to cause something to happen. And that's not what it is at all.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you discussed that.
That's right. The data is out on that. And it's totally a myth. Mm-hmm. No one was like, nobody out here with depression is walking through their life going like, I think I'm just going to hang in there a little longer. And then a loved one asks and they're like, great idea. Never thought of that. It's just not how it works.
No. And it is. I mean, I worked in that, an inpatient mental health facility. And it was a question that we had to ask. We asked all of our patients, they got to ask that question multiple times a day as a check-in. And it is something that like it, in the beginning, it was like, oh, this is not like, this is uncomfortable. I asked this question to people all the time. And so sometimes I don't realize that it is something it can be very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. For people to ask, but it's a question that sometimes I'll ask the question and the person is like, well, yeah, I have had those thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it's like this is the first time somebody's directly asked me, or you kind of, and it just opens a door for them to feel like they're being heard and that there's help available.
That's right. Yeah.
So one of the big questions that we had for you, and we're finally going to get to it, was that when I had read some information you had posted in one of our listservs, I just knew I had to talk to you. And Jen and I both agree that we would really need to talk to you about this topic. Please tell us about your work and what is psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy?
Yeah, let's get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so... psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is using therapy alongside medicine. I'm going to use that word pretty strategically, that have typically been classified as psychedelics or recreational drugs, using them legally, mindfully for healing purposes in safe ways with good ethical guidelines and boundaries. I've been a big believer in like experiential therapy for a long time. IFS therapy that I've plugged a couple times is very experiential. It's moving inside, active imagination, guided imagery. And so that's how I came into this world of wanting to learn about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. So it's often an adjacent therapy. So somebody is in long-term outpatient therapy, and then they may decide to pursue short-term psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Right now, there's a lot of research being done in this area around different medicines. Psilocybin, which is the active compound that we would call magic mushrooms in our culture, is being researched for treatment-resistant depression, end-of-life anxiety, a myriad of other things. MDMA, which is not actually a psychedelic, but we kind of group it in to this class of medicines, is very promising for PTSD. Both of these medicines are being considered by FDA for wider therapeutic use. They've been approved in Australia in the spring, both of them for limited therapeutic use. There's compassionate use laws in Canada. And so there's a lot of excitement around it, and it typically looks like, just kind of get into the nitty gritty, somebody who has done other types of therapy before that has not worked for them, and they go through a period of assessment for both physical and psychological safety, and then a period of preparation, so preparing to have a psychedelic experience in a therapeutic setting. Then after 1, 2, 3, usually 2 or more preparation sessions, they have a medicine experience with the psychedelic that they're using. For ketamine, which we'll get into, it's typically a 2-hour session. MDMA and psilocybin can be 8 hours or more. There's often co-therapy teams, so there's 2 therapists sitting in the room for those longer medicine sessions, because people got to go to the bathroom, people got to go have their lunch, so that the client, the participant, is never left alone. Okay. And then there's a series of what we call integration sessions. So if you went in and you did your dosing medicine session on a Monday, usually that Tuesday you would be meeting together with your therapy team to integrate any new insights, experiences, any points of distress that came up in the dosing session. And there are all sorts of different schedules on how much prep, how much integration, how many dosing sessions. That's like a big question, but that's the basic flow that we're talking about when we talk about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy.
Can you, and you talked about it, like one of the options being ketamine assisted psychotherapy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. So right now, ketamine is legally available above ground. MDMA and psilocybin are only available in research settings at the moment because we're waiting for the FDA to make a decision about them. Though it looks promising, the government takes a long time to do things. Mm-hmm. So ketamine is technically not a psychedelic. It's a dissociative anesthesia. We've been using it at significantly higher doses for decades. It's for anesthesia purposes during things like surgery, battlefield injuries. It's one of the WHO's top 10 essential medicines. That's how widely it's being used. Yeah, it's being used super widely globally. In the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy world, we're using it at a much smaller dose that creates a comparable psychedelic effect in clients. So we're doing the psychological assessment, the medical safety assessment, the preparation, and then we're typically doing a series of dosing sessions and integration sessions with clients. There is also another model of ketamine treatment, which is like, we call it IV only or medical only, where people go in to a clinic and they receive ketamine typically through IV. And it for psychological purposes, for depression purposes, but without the psychotherapeutic component. I think that can help some people. I also think there's some risks associated. But so when we're talking about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, we're talking about it in the context of all the therapeutic support, not just ketamine, getting ketamine.
Mm-hmm. So if you were to walk us through this treatment, how would this ketamine, you know, I'm blown away. I did not know it was one of the top used medications. Do you know that, Jen? I mean,
I know that. I mean, I hear more and more people talking about it, more and more people requesting like information and asking for providers, and more and more like practices that are now currently offering ketamine. I feel like it seems like ketamine and TMS have kind of, I've seen like this upsurge in looking in just having more options for people who are struggling with more of that like resistance in like treatment resistant depression, and even just starting to hear more about using it with like with some other mood disorders and some other struggles.
Yeah, and to clarify, it's on the WHO list not only because of its psychological effects, but because of its anesthesia properties.
So right.
Just point of clarification, it's so widely used for anesthesia in significantly higher doses.
Yeah. And how would this work in our brain, specifically when we're having these depressive symptoms? How would that, you know, help? I'm assuming, you know, maybe for some folks, they've already done other types of treatments, more, let's say, traditional treatments, or maybe trying traditional, you know, psychotropic medication, how would that work in their brains? Like, just say, I have depression and I wanted to try this type of treatment. How would that alleviate some of these depressive symptoms that someone's having?
Yeah, so like we were using the river metaphor, the downstream metaphor before. Things like SSRIs, traditional medication, it's really helping the body to conserve and utilize things like the serotonin directly in our body. Ketamine is doing some really interesting things, quote, upstream of the serotonin processes. So a couple of examples. Ketamine works on the GABA and the glutamate systems. It's as if, I'm going to talk in metaphor because I'm not like a neuroscientist, and mm-hmm. I think that would probably serve everyone better. It's as if ketamine can flip a switch in the brain when somebody's been depressed for a long time. Their connections in their brain can start to break down, which means that they have to over-rely on the connections that still exist. And so we get into things like ruminative thought. We get into negative thinking patterns in a very literal brain way. When ketamine does what it does with GABA and glutamate systems, it leads to neural connections being strengthened, a more diverse web of neural connections being strengthened again, and actually even new connections being formed, which is why we take the therapeutic part of CAP, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, so seriously. We want to get our eyeballs on somebody and make sure that while they're in this more suggestible, open state, that they're not watching a bunch of scary movies, but instead maybe journaling, instead walking their dog. And we were also watching for the downstream effects to start to play out. Another really cool thing that ketamine does in the brain is it temporarily quiets the default mode network in the brain. The DMN, that's the part of your brain that's like reeling on something when you're not focused on any particular like physical task. So when you're driving and you're worried about your meeting or you're doing the dishes and you're hashing for the 1100th time what your partner said to you, many of us struggle with that type of ruminative thought. And that's especially true for people with depression and other mental health concerns. Ketamine can temporarily quiet that down. It quiets it down a whole lot in the ketamine experience, but it can keep it quiet for a series of days, weeks, months, probably not months, but once you've trained yourself to give yourself some space around it, you can actually tap back into it for some people. And it allows new patterns of thought to emerge. How many of us are just stuck in the same old perspective? Ketamine can make it possible in a very real way for new ideas to come to people about themselves, about their depression, about what they want from their lives. And that sort of novelty, it's so crucial in treating something like depression that has really shut someone's system down. A really common symptom of depression is not even being interested in the things that you used to like, right? Mm-hmm. Not even what you know works for you. And ketamine can make it feel safer and more possible for people to do things like seek novelty, which is a really important part of being a human without depression.
Mm-hmm. Can you, Autumn, talk to us a little bit about what like the typical course of treatment would look like if somebody was interested in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, like what that course of treatment could potentially look like for them?
Absolutely. So typically either myself or Richard Clark, who's the prescriber we work with in our practice. I'm going to get really specific about what we do here, right? Because there's a million different protocols.
Yeah.
What we do here is one of us has an initial consultation and answers a bunch of questions, helps people to really get an understanding of what they can expect and what we can and can't sort of promise, because there's so many treatment protocols out there. There's so much stuff online that's like, this is going to fix your depression. And so we've got to really walk some of that back, really make sure the process is clear and understood. So we do a free consultation call for anybody who's got questions about that. If it seems like people are a good fit and they want to move forward, I do a 1-hour mental health assessment with people. Rick does like about a half hour call with them to clear them medically, and then does any other follow-up work that needs to be done if they have any complicating medical issues. Ketamine is a very safe medicine. Again, it's used much higher doses in in things like battlefield settings and anesthesia. It's very frequently used in the ER. It's because it has very few like toxicity issues. Like if we don't know what's in someone's system, ketamine is really a quite a safe thing to give them if they need some sort of anesthesia. So anyway, that was a caveat. Rick and I kind of do our thing. We make sure somebody's safe to do the ketamine, that we think they're going to be able to get a lot out of the experience. I then meet with them for two preparation sessions, getting to know them more, walking them through all of the logistics that they need to know, as well as spending quite a lot of time on intention setting, expectations, safety, boundaries, all that good stuff that's so important to create a safe therapeutic container for somebody to have ketamine. Once that's complete, we usually do a series. We start with three, although people can do more than that, of alternating between those dosing sessions and integration sessions. So a dosing session is 2 hours long. They come here to the office. I'm with them in the room the whole time while they receive ketamine. And then it's often worn off a half hour or so before it's time to go, and we start doing a little integration work then. It's really important to kind of get in there and reflect on the experience. And then the following day, I meet with them and do a full integration session. And we usually do that combo of dosing integration at least three times. And then we send it back to your outpatient therapist, right? We really see what we're doing as adjacent to outpatient therapy, not replacing it.
In post, you know, post-ketamine treatment, would you require boosters, or how does that work?
Yes.
With clients, you know, like how would that work after they've done this many sessions with in your clinic?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought this up. I think there's a lot of misconceptions here. So the effects that I spoke about of ketamine on the brain, those effects fade. And so it's very common for people with treatment-resistant depression to require ongoing boosters with ketamine. And that can happen in this CAP model of ketamine-assisted psychotherapy with the dosing sessions and the integration sessions. We set folks up on a schedule that works for them, and we really play it by ear. Ketamine treatment is expensive. And so we're not just being like, all right, you've signed up for once a month for the rest of your life. If you don't need it, you don't need it, right? Some people for whom their treatment-resistant depression is, it turns out to be like extremely biological heavy, genetic heavy, those folks will likely need ongoing boosters to maintain their benefit. And the hope is that the ketamine makes their progress in therapy more effective. So they're able to then do the things that they know will protect them as much as they can against future depressive episodes. And if biology eventually sort of takes over, ketamine is there as a support to them, which is just so huge in people's quality of life, of knowing that there's a tool that is available to them that can work. It can really kind of puncture through that dread and help people to just get more out of the times where they're feeling less depressed or not depressed. Some folks will have a really powerful experience with ketamine. It'll really help them make progress in their regular therapy. They'll get some clarity about some patterns that they can change pretty quickly. And they may come and do three ketamine sessions and I might never see them again. And that's great too. It really depends on, and we don't always know up front, but is this mood episode or other mental health concern really being fueled by some things that the ketamine is going to help them to adjust in their external life? Or are they going to just need more consistent support for the long term?
I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating as a new, well, not so new, I guess, but maybe you. more better known now type of treatment that might be very helpful for people that other things have not, they just haven't worked for them.
Yeah, I think you're right.
One of the things that we always like to ask our guests is what they like most about their work. And to be honest, Autumn, it sounds like you're thrilled. With this topic that's kind of, you know, a somber one, you know, this time around, but what do you like the most about working with depression, and specifically even the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy?
I think my favorite thing is sitting with people in the room who are having ketamine for the first time. They're always nervous, understandably so. They don't know what this experience is going to be like. And I just love to get to sit and hold safe space for them here mm-hmm. in the room so that they're free to explore whatever the ketamine is going to bring up for them. This might sound sort of strange. I've had ketamine as a part of my training. I think that's a really important question to ask your ketamine therapist is if they've had their own experience or experiences with ketamine. Through my work and my own experience, I've come to really trust the process of ketamine therapy and watch it really help people. And it's just like so cool to get to have a front row seat, no matter if they have a really blissful experience, a challenging experience, just to get to accompany people and to be able to offer this tool. In psychedelic therapy, we often talk about the medicine as like power tools, right? So you got to be careful. There's got to be limits in place and boundaries. Man, to have something that works pretty well so much of the time, it's like mm-hmm. so sacred to me. It's like more than therapy, what we're doing mm-hmm. in that room together, and to just be trusted in such a tender moment. People are coming seeking relief. I love that about it. I really love it. Yeah.
Well, and that definitely comes through in how you've kind of explained things to us and talked through things to us. I love like the different metaphors you use and how you explain things that made it so much easier to understand. Oh, I've been to like trainings and like presentations where people, well, there will be more like scientific approaches to mm-hmm. ketamine, and I'm like, this is just going right over my head. I like don't understand it, and it didn't click, but you definitely kind of helped us to understand it, and it shows the passion that you have for what you do.
Oh,
one of the things that we also, talk with our guests about is what is the most frequently asked questions you get either when you're out places personally and you tell, people that you're what you do and that you're a therapist and this is, the area, the field that you work in, or like when you're doing a consultation with a mm-hmm. client or in a session, like what's the most frequently asked question you tend to get?
Hands down, people want me to be able to tell them what their ketamine experience is going to be like, or what is it to have ketamine in your body, right?
It's like a million dollars. You're like this is a crystal ball moment. Like let me tell you what.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. As soon as people find out what I do, they're like, "What's that like to have ketamine?" And so, really, like I'm often very vague if a client is asking this because I'm actively prepping them for their experience. And I like really want to minimize comparing their experience to mine. Mm-hmm. They're going to have ketamine often in a matter of days. And so like my highlights of my ketamine experience is really not helpful for them in that moment. But to you all, knowing that if any client finds me from here, they'll have weeks at least between this conversation and that one, I will say that like it's truly indescribable. It's one of the most beautiful, most intense experiences I've ever had. I feel like I, in my first ketamine experience, was able to sort of revisit past moments of joy and despair with clarity, with love. Mm. People often describe seeing things like beautiful landscapes, sometimes scary images. I feel like ketamine helped me make peace with suffering, which is something I think a lot of therapists need help with because we see so much suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've had conversations with friends and former enemies in that space, really like resolved some relationship dynamics in myself that then I, of course, had to go like walk out with that other person. It's really changed like the work, both working with clients and my own work has really changed my life for the better of my career. I'm a better parent. It's very practical as well as the sort of these big like, quote, mystical experiences. That's one thing I love about it is that like you can have this mind-blowing experience and then 3 days later you're like, huh, I walked the dog without the dread. Wonder what that's about. And it's really cool and kind of balanced in that way. So whenever people ask about that, I like to kind of try to, I just gave you all of the like cool experience notes.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I like to sort of balance it out with the like, and this tail end of it is really, it's not less like important.
What do you think is something like the, a big myth? You know, like one of the reasons why we started this podcast was to kind of demystify therapy. And so that's why, you know, every time that we have a guest expert, we're trying to demystify that area that they are the expert in, just so that the public will know, hey, therapy's not so scary, or maybe this is a good idea. Or, you know, I had that question, but I was too scared to ask it. And so we do the asking, right? So if we're going to, like, you know, kind of demystify something or like a myth that you maybe misunderstood, what would that be that you think in the field of psychology or just anything in area of therapy? What would be something you want to demystify?
Yeah. So I would say that there is any magic pill out there, that there's any quick fix out there, right? I just described something so powerful, but I would include ketamine in that.
Okay.
Like, it's still work. My friends who are other therapists in this area, we always joke that, like, we should be like ketamine therapy, and then our subtitle should be like, it's still work. You still have to go home at the end of the day.
You still got to do the work, buddy.
You still have to do the work. Those who, you might get some temporary relief without the work, but most people need more than just temporary relief. So I would say that that is the biggest one. I also think this idea that certain treatments work for very specific diagnoses, and so nobody else outside of that treatment will benefit. I think about like things like dialectical behavior therapy. When I think of that, like, we used to only treat people with a certain set of mental health concerns, and now we've like, oh, that's actually works more for a lot of other things. The same is true for ketamine assisted therapy. It can help with trauma, it can help with other things. And so I would say, just another, I'm going to give you two myths, is that, like, I have to perfectly match my diagnostic label to the treatment always, and then nothing else should be considered. I think it's more of an art. I know I went on about evidence-based, and I, you know, two things can be true, right?
Right.
It's
absolutely.
Have the evidence-based, and it's an art form of finding a good fit.
I love that.
Yeah. I do too. Well, Autumn, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I feel like this has been such an enlightening. I mean, I feel like there's definitely some difficult topics that we touched on today, and I learned quite a bit listening to you talk more about some of the treatment options. So it was great having you with us.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me wax poetic about all of this. I loved it. Me too.
Yes. So thank you. For more information on Autumn Starks, check out her website, www.starkstherapygroup.com, Starks Therapy Group on Facebook, and at Starks Therapy Group on Instagram. Thank you for listening. And as always, subscribe to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy, But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast everywhere you listen to good podcasts, and give us your 5-star review. Follow us on Instagram at therapy_podcast_ for updates, additional information, and message us topics and questions you always wanted to know but were too afraid to ask.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to good podcasts. And keep up with episode updates on Instagram at therapy_podcast_. There, you can send us messages on topics you'd like to hear about or anything that comes to mind. Bye for now.